This is day 5 of this January 2017 Rohatsu 7-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday, the letters and lectures of Chinese Zen Master Da Wei, and the book is called Swampland Flowers. Da Wei is a 12th century Chan master. We left off in his letter to one of his disciples. Just finish it up. He writes, "When you see it as it really is, practice according to reality and act according to reality, then you can manifest the Jewel King's realm on the tip of a hair and turn the wheel of the great Dharma while sitting within an atom of dust. And creating all things or destroying all things is entirely up to oneself. Like a strong man flexing his arm, you don't depend on the strength of others. Like a lion strolling along, you won't seek companions. When all sorts of states of surpassing wonder appear before you, you won't marvel at them. When all sorts of states of evil deeds appear before you, you won't fear them. In the conduct of your daily activities, you will be abandoned and expansive, free and independent wherever you go." This is about the states of surpassing wonder and states of evil deeds. We can take as makyo, side effects of strong sitting, deep sitting, when the brain is, and the mind is shifting, opening, and our ordinary ways of seeing things and hearing things and so forth are starting to change. Makyo are a good sign in that they don't usually happen when one is just at the surface of one's practice, but they're dangerous in that if you get caught in them, if you become in the thrall of them, then you get sidetracked from the practice. Here's another very short letter. "In the conduct of their daily activities, sentient beings have no illumination. If you go along with their ignorance, they're happy. If you oppose their ignorance, they become vexed. Buddhas and bodhisattvas are not this way. They make use of ignorance, considering this the business of Buddhas. Since sentient beings make ignorance their home, to go against it amounts to breaking up their home. Going with it is adapting to where they're at to influence and guide them." This is what, in the realm of what we might call skillful means, upaya, is the Indian word for it, in which you need to, and this would also be for anyone working with or interacting with friends, family, others, find a way to help them understand the Dharma in such a way that they won't resist or fight back, that they won't dismiss it out of hand. It's a very broad kind of proposition, but there are plenty of ways to find to influence people for the better. by yielding when it's called for. Roshi Kapler used to say, sometimes you have to give people what they want in order for them to want what you have to give them. This is the wisdom required to help another find a way in, to help them understand that you're with them and not fighting them. There's a verse in the Mumonkan: if you meet a swordsman in the street, give him a sword. If you meet an unpoetical man, don't offer him a poem. Fundamental principle of teaching and helping is to accommodate the teaching to the listener. Oh yes, I see here now that this letter was written to some kind of military man, Commander Chang Yi Shi. Here's another letter. A monk, he quotes Yunmen, or Umon. A monk asked Yunmen, "What is Buddha?" Yunmen said, "A dry piece of shit." It's a famous koan. That's the whole koan, the shortest ones. It's in the Mumonkan. And then to this recipient of this letter must be working on this, because Da Wei says, just bring up these words. When all your machinations suddenly come to an end, then you'll awaken. It's a rich word in terms of this practice and the commonest of mistakes, machinations, the strategizing, analyzing. There's some words that escape me right now, but something like you want to contrive to find a way through, but only death to contrivance will do. We when we are feeling frustrated, we resort to plotting, to seeing if we can finesse our way through the koan, and this just engages the discriminating mind, and so it can't really work. Practice is fundamentally a matter of heart, putting yourself into it wholly. In ancient times, I've read the master would assign a student a koan like Joshu's Mu and not even tell them how to work on it. No techniques. No strategy. Just go at it. You see the evidence of this of the mistake of strategizing when people ask, is there something I'm doing I could do? Is there something I'm doing wrong? Could you explain to me again, maybe in this more detail, exactly No, you know. You know how to do this. You put your whole mind into it. Which doesn't mean straining, but you put your whole mind into it. And you'll find your way in it, through it. Trust it. Trust this mind. Trust your own sincerity. That always wins in the end. As we go on in our practice, our practice becomes refined on its own. We don't have to be instructed. We find our way. We find the way. If we're working sincerely, you're not doing anything wrong. Even if one were doing something that wasn't very effective, then you'll find your way past it. That's the genius of this simplest of practices, just the sitting and looking, is we find our way through the obstruction, the mistake, if you want to call it that. It doesn't bring results, so we shift, we find another way of going at it. When all your machinations suddenly come to an end, then you'll awaken. Don't seek to draw realization from the words or try in your confusion to assess and explain. Even if you could explain clearly and speak to the point, this would all be phantom plans. If your feelings of questioning are not smashed, birth and death go on. If your feelings of questioning are smashed, then the mind of birth and death is cut off. With the mind of birth and death cut off, views of Buddha and Dharma perish. With views even of Buddha and Dharma gone, how could you go on to create any views of sentient beings and affliction? Just take your confused, unhappy mind and shift it onto Mu. Once you hold it there, then the mind that fears birth and death, the mind that's confused and unhappy, the mind which thinks and discriminates, the mind that acts intelligent will naturally no longer operate. When you become aware that it's not operating, don't be afraid of falling into emptiness. Just to back up, he said, views of Buddha and Dharma perish. What a religion, or what a no religion, that the two of the most exalted features of doctrine, the Buddha himself and his teaching, Dharma, we want to get rid of. No attachment, no concept of Buddha or Dharma. It's just an obstruction. No image. It's just an obstruction. Zen Master Basui said, cut, 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 cut. Don't be afraid of falling into emptiness. Well, most people are very much afraid the first time they find the mind empty and the mind without thoughts. It can be quite frightening. But it needn't be. If you hang in there, you see that you are just fine. You're not disappearing, or hopefully you are, but not in the way you think, not in the way you're afraid of. And then he finishes, suddenly and holding firm to the koan, the scene is cut off for an entire lifetime of unexcelled joy and happiness. Is a letter to a Zhang Jian Yu. Constantly calculating and making plans, flowing along with birth and death, becoming afraid and agitated, all these are sentiments of discriminating consciousness. Yet people on the path these days do not recognize this disease and just appear and disappear into it. In the teachings, it's called acting according to discriminating consciousness, not according to wisdom. Thereby, they obscure the scenery of the fundamental ground, their original face. But if you can abandon it all at once, so you neither think nor calculate, suddenly losing your footing as you tread upon your nostrils, then these very sentiments of discriminating consciousness are the subtle wisdom of true emptiness. There is no other wisdom that can be attained. There is nothing that has any enduring substance to it. Even these discriminating thoughts, concepts, are empty. They have no roots. We don't need to fear them. We don't need to fear our thoughts. They're just floating. We don't need to banish them. They'll just evaporate on their own if we don't feed them with our attention. How do we not feed our thoughts with our attention? By shifting our attention back to the practice and feeding the practice with our attention. You have to choose. Which do you want to nourish? The thoughts or the practice that you're working on? Just a word about birth and death. This we read over and over and over and over and over again in Zen texts, and Buddhist texts actually. Birth and death, to make it, for people who can't relate that much to birth and that phrase, just think of it as change. The world of change. And you'll, with a little reflection, you'll know that in all kinds of ways, you fear change. You want to hold on to things as they are. But change can very much be our friend when we're in pain, when we're suffering in any kind of way. Change will be there. And the pain will pass. Or at the very least, it'll change. It'll moderate. Suffering a loss of any kind, financial, personal, it'll change in time. We do get over it. Be so grateful for this dharma of impermanence. Here's another letter. Before emotional consciousness has been smashed, the mind fire burns bright. At just such a time, just take a saying you have doubts about to arouse and awaken yourself. The translator here translates what we would call a koan into saying. So he's saying, just take a koan that you have questions about. For example, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou said, no, or moo. Just bring this up to arouse and awaken yourself. Whatever side you come at it from, that's not it. You're wrong. Moreover, don't use mind to await enlightenment. And you shouldn't take up the saying in the citation of it. And you shouldn't understand it as the original subtlety, or discuss it as existent or non-existent, or assess it as the nothingness of true nothingness. These are things he's heard students trot into the Doksan room and say, oh, it is the nothingness of true nothingness. And you shouldn't sit in the bag of unconcern. That is, get bogged down in quiescence, mental quiet, peace. Peace is great. So something many people in this world would be happy to settle into. But we can go further, deeper, and find even deeper peace, enduring peace, not peace that changes when sesshin is over, that slips away. And you shouldn't understand it in sparks struck from stone or in the brilliance of a lightning flash. Yeah, more enticing images to get stuck in. There should be no place to employ your mind. There should be no place to employ your mind, meaning the discriminating mind. It reminds me of an exchange with Zen Master Zhao Zhou, where a monk asked him, on what should one who wears the Buddhist robe focus his mind? And Zhao Zhou said, where there is no design. No picture, no features, no borders or any kind of lines or inside, outside. How in the world can we reach such a place? It's not easy because the mind always wants to hang on to forms and create new forms. New things to get involved in. Should be no place to employ your mind. No place for the mind to get traction in conceptualizing. Sounds, to someone who's never been there, it sounds out of reach, but it's not. Through sheer concentration on the practice, we can reach such a place. There's no place to employ the mind, no need to employ the mind. No need to have the mind working. So when there's no place for mind, don't be afraid of falling into emptiness. On the contrary, this is a good place. Suddenly the rat enters a hollow ox horn, and then wrong views are cut off. this affair is neither difficult nor easy. Only if you have already planted deep the seeds of transcendent wisdom and served those of knowledge through vast eons without beginning and developed correct knowledge and correct views, does it strike you continuously in your present conduct as you meet situations and encounter circumstances in the midst of radiant spiritual consciousness, like recognizing your own parents in a crowd of people. That's the longest sentence, I think, in this book. At such a time, you don't have to ask anyone else. Naturally, the seeking mind does not scatter and run off. Here's more about the danger of mental quietude. It's another letter. Generally, those who have been overly involved in worldly affairs for a long time have long been stuck like glue in the afflictions of the senses. When unexpectedly it happens that someone instructs them to do some meditation in a quiet place, and they temporarily get a feeling of calm, they immediately take this as the ultimate in peace and happiness. They are far from realizing that quiescence is like a rock pressing down on the grass. Though for a time they become aware that the scene is cut off, nevertheless the root and branches are still there. When will they experience quiescent extinction to the full? If you want to have real quiescent extinction appear before you, you must make a sudden leap within the fires of birth and death and leap out without moving a hair's breadth. Then you'll turn the rivers into pure ghee and the earth into gold. Faced with situations, you'll be free to release or capture, to kill or bring life. No device to benefit others or benefit yourself will be impossible. He's referring to a state of deep enlightenment. But this must make a sudden leap. Another verse in the Mumonkan, you need take no steps, just let go your hold on the cliff. It's a good image, this like a rock pressing down on grass. I picture tall grass. They wouldn't have had our manicured lawns in 12th century China. But sure, the grass bends down under the weight of the rock, but it does nothing to the roots. That's what he's warning about in terms of settling for deep calm. Another letter to a secretary, Lu. In the old days, the venerable Yan Yang asked Zhao Zhou, what's it like when not bringing a single thing? Zhao said, put it down. Yan Yang said, since not a single thing is brought, put what down? Zhao Zhou said, well, if you can't put it down, pick it up. At these words, Yan Yang was greatly enlightened. There are other translations of this. It's a koan in the Shoyo Roku, the Book of Equanimity. Zhao Zhou says, a single thing means a single thought. And Zhao Zhou says, well, lay it down. And the monk says, well, wait, how can I do that if I don't have anything in my mind? He says, all right, then, carry it out. And then Da Wei quotes another dialogue. A monk asked an ancient worthy, what's it like when the student can't cope? It's a common question. One form or another, coming down to that. What it's like when the student can't cope? The ancient worthy, the teacher said, I too am like this. The monk said, teacher, why can't you cope either? The ancient worthy said, if I could cope, I could take away this inability to cope of yours. At these words, the monk was greatly enlightened. He must have realized all at once that not just that the teacher can't in any fundamental way change him, that's his own job, but that the teacher doesn't need to. It is for oneself to change from within. If I could cope, I could take away this inability to cope of yours. What teacher would not want to utter a few words or wave a magic wand to help the student through? Most of the teacher's words fall on deaf ears. I learned that many years ago. They're most likely to be heard. The teacher's words are most likely to be to really go in late in Sesshin. Other than that, most of the teacher's words are just ricocheting off the student. Late in Sesshin, the student's mind is open, receptive, absorbent, quiet, ready. Then some of the teacher's words get through. But this is the school of direct experience, then. It's not primarily a matter of this teacher giving teaching in some conventional way. It's all there within each student. Student just has to mine her own wisdom. Another letter. If you want to practice the way, you must have settled faith, so your mind does not waver whether favorable or adverse environments are encountered. Only then do you have some direction in the way. The Buddha said, faith can forever destroy the root of affliction. Faith can focus you on the virtues of Buddhahood. Faith has no attachments to objects. Far removed from all difficulties, you get so there is no difficulty. He also said, faith can transcend the numerous roads of delusion and display the path of unexcelled liberation. I also feel that faith is the single most important ingredient in practice. The most important requirement is faith. Doesn't mean faith in Lord Buddha. That's not what Zen is about. It begins and ends with faith in the practice one is working on. That's it. We recited it a little while ago, the Hakuin chant, upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving, the countless good deeds, the way of right living, all come from Zazen. All come from this mu. The question, what is it? Who am I? The breath. It's all there. It's all we need to overturn the mind, to reveal the self nature of ours. Faith. Faith in the practice. The wonderful thing about practice is the more we nourish this practice, the koan or the breath, the more we work it, the more it gives back to us, the more it develops faith. In Zen, faith is based on experience, not belief. Not belief. We don't need to have even learned anything about Buddhism. But if we have faith, enough faith in the practice we're working on, to keep returning to it, going deeper and deeper into it, then we will be showered with faith. More faith. We discover it works. And that gives us more faith. And that enables us to more concentratedly work on the practice, which showers us with more benefits, which increases faith. And this late stage of Sesshin is where our faith can be sorely tested. Invested a lot of effort, and we want to see results. It's natural. And when we run into another roadblock, run into an obstruction in the mind, we run into discouragement, self-doubt, our faith is tested. We don't have to bring up images of Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. Just get back to the practice we're working on. It'll draw us out of that quagmire of self-doubt or discouragement or anything else. So one thing that's non-negotiable in order for real success in this practice is just keep going back to the practice. He continues in this letter, in the teachings there are clear passages like the above. How could Buddha deceive people? If you're half light and half dark, half believing and half not believing, then whenever you meet with situations and encounter circumstances, your mind produces doubt and confusion. This is mind having attachments to objects. Not being able to be definite and have no doubts about this path to destroy the root of affliction and get away from all difficulty is entirely due to lack of settled faith, to being confused by the delusions of one's own personal existence. It is a battle. That's how Yasutani Roshi likens it in the Three Pillars of Zen. I'm not as fond, generally, of military analogies, but this, it's true. It's a battle. When you're in there, and being assailed once again. You thought you'd gotten free of thoughts, that things were going to be smooth going, and then you stumble into another snarl of thoughts. Okay, you don't have to get in there and get rid of them. You just have to go back to the practice with renewed commitment to the practice. No mental obstruction, no barrier can stand up for long against that kind of devoted practice, devotion to the practice you're working on. Every one of them dissolves. Dharma gates beyond measure I vow to penetrate. It's just through faith in the practice. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind patterns. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attend all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to manage it. The great way of Buddha, I bow to attend. All beings without number, I bow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I bow to uproot. Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.